Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Jim Naughton is a two-time Tony Award-winning actor and lifelong resident here in Connecticut, and he's actually been advocating for medical aid in dying for the past 3 years. Now, Jim, my understanding, your wife passed away of pancreatic cancer back in 2013, so this has been a very personal issue for you. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, that's right, Melissa. The way it came about that I am so supportive of this legislation is that Pam and I battled pancreatic cancer for 4 years. During that time, after they had run out of different chemos to throw at it, after about 2.5 years of her from her diagnosis, we had nothing left really to treat the cancer with, and her doctor handed me a phone number and said, "There's a new trial for a new drug going on in San Antonio, Texas. Why don't you give them a call?" So I did. And he sent them all of her paperwork, and they wanted to see her. So we got on a plane. We flew to San Antonio. We got off the plane. It was August. It was 114 degrees and blowing. It was like being in a blast furnace. But the good news was that she qualified for the trial. And so for the next 8 months, we traveled each week to San Antonio on Tuesday. She was treated on Wednesday, and we came home on Thursday. The point there being, I guess, that you do whatever it takes when you're in that situation.
Sure.
And at the end of the fourth year, things had really started to deteriorate for Pam. And she surprised me one day. She looked at me in the morning, and she said, "You know, Jimmy, I don't want to wake up anymore."
Wow.
And when she saw my reaction, she said, "Well, we've always known this was a fatal disease." And that night at 11 o'clock when I climbed into bed with her, she woke up and she looked at me in the dark and she said, "Oh, I thought I wasn't going to have to wake up anymore." And the feeling of disappointment that I felt, the failure I felt, that I couldn't help her at that point, I couldn't help her out. Because what she wanted finally was to be let go, was really overwhelming.
Can you kind of outline, you know, what would this mean, the medical aid in dying bill? You know, what is it and why, you know, like, why would it help people like Pam?
It's been the law in Oregon since 1997. We have a 23-year history of knowing how this thing has been met and handled and used. It's not used very much. But for the people who are at the end of their lives, who have less than 6 months to live, this law stipulates that two doctors have to diagnose you as having less than 6 months to live.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be of sound mind, mentally capable. You can't just be a depressed person who wants to end it. There are all kinds of other stipulations that a person who is at the end and suffering. I just lost a very dear friend of mine, a wonderful actor named Rene Aubergenois, who died a year ago last December in California, which has this law since 2015. He had stage 4 metastatic lung cancer, and he lived with it for several years. But he said, "You know, I just don't want to get to the point where I won't recognize my own grandchildren when they walk in the room."
It's devastating.
Because that does come with the end of life.
Sure.
There are neurological problems, and you have seizures. And so he, a year ago in December, he was able to say, "I'm very proud that my family and I live in a state that recognizes a person's right to die with dignity." And he, with his children and his wife at his bedside, spent a Saturday morning looking through old photographs and listening to their favorite music, and then he took the medicine, and he was able to die peacefully, and it was right at the end.
Mm-hmm.
That was a choice that my wife, Pam, didn't have, and I kind of made a promise, I think, at that time that I would try to help make this available, this option available to people who were at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I have another story to tell you. A woman here in Connecticut who spent her career as a hospice nurse a few years ago developed stage 4 lung cancer, and she testified, as did I, before the Public Health Committee of the legislature 2 years ago and again this year, saying, please pass this. I know what it is. I know what I have, and I know what it's going to take for me at the end, and I would love to have this option. Well, Connecticut hasn't done it yet, and so a few months ago, she put her house in Middletown on the market, and she went and established residency in a state that does have this available. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a terrible thing to have to do to somebody right at the end, when they need their neighborhood and their friends and their support system and their doctors, mm-hmm. to have to make her sell her house and go live someplace else because we don't have this available.
You know what's interesting about this, Jim, is the fact that it is authorized already in other states that have this.
There are 11 states so far. In fact, 2 weeks ago, New Mexico became the 11th state that passed it. Governor Lamont has said he'll sign it. We're at a critical moment right now, today. And so if your listeners are supportive of this idea, I would ask them to call their state representatives and state senators and say, we want this to come to the floor. In 2015, 63% of Connecticut residents supported the legislation. Today, 75% support it. Right across the board, all different gender groups, ethnic groups, religious groups, even 65% of people with disabilities would like to have this legislation. So I think it's an idea, hopefully, whose time has come.
Jim Naughton, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
And good morning, everyone. I'm excited to talk about this 501c3 charitable organization. It's called Partner in Lyme. In fact, it just turned 1 in January. The executive director is Jessica. Now, Jessica has a connection to Lyme disease, specifically in her family. And Jessica, forgive me, in all the times you and I have talked, I never asked you how to pronounce your name, and I don't want to butcher it on the air. How do you say your last name?
That's okay. It's Schneider.
Schneider. Okay. You know, I was going to go with that, but I didn't want to be wrong. So Jessica Schneider is here this morning. And Jess, my understanding is your daughter is battling Lyme disease right now, correct?
Correct. Yes, she is.
So, I mean, what sort of prompted you? First of all, what did you find with your daughter's journey? First of all, praying for your daughter. I hope she has a full recovery because I've had plenty of friends who are going through Lyme disease and it's horrible. But, you know, what is it about your daughter's journey that sort of led you to go, you know what, I think we need to help more people out financially when they're diagnosed with Lyme?
Sure. Yeah. Grace was not unlike many other people who come to a diagnosis after visiting many, many doctors and trying many different treatments and different testing. So it took us about 10 doctors and about a year and a half before we discovered that what she was suffering from was actually from a tick from Lyme disease. And what we didn't know at the time, like, we were excited thinking, yay, now we have a diagnosis. We know how to start. We know how to treat this. But what we were not prepared for was the realization that Lyme disease is not covered under insurance policies.
Really?
Doctors who treat Lyme disease in the chronic stage do not take any insurance. So it's a completely self-funded disease. And the average person with chronic Lyme can spend up to $50,000 a year out of pocket on treatment.
Wow.
And so,
wow.
You know, I saw that financial realization and also the burden that it placed on her life. She was diagnosed at just 18 years old, and her whole life took a different course based mm-hmm. on this information. And so, you know, I talked to my husband, Greg, and we said, we can really be angry about this, and we can feel like this is something that's really unfair that happened to her. Or we can use this as an opportunity to thank God that we have the financial resources to give her the treatment that she needs. And we can turn this into a blessing and bless other people who may not have the funding to, you know, get the specialized testing or visit a Lyme literate doctor or go to a massage therapist or get a sauna for their home. So we set out to create an organization that would give that little bit of extra money to spend in any way that helps that patient heal in body, mind, and spirit.
That's amazing. I love the work that you guys are doing. I think this is so cool. I'm going to backtrack really quick. First of all, I think it's shocking that we don't cover it, that insurance doesn't cover it, because Lyme disease is, you know, living in the Northeast, we talk about Lyme disease all the time. I mean, what's interesting is we only really talk about it in spring and summer. But I mean, Jess, I'm sure you're realizing, Jessica, that it's something that could be a problem all year round, correct?
It is a problem year round. Ticks are found in every state, in every continent, except Antarctica. And they're active year-round here. So it's not just a spring and summer disease, although we do celebrate Lyme Awareness Month in May, and so that gets everyone talking about it. Ticks are active all year long. They don't die in the winter here. It's not cold enough, and the snow actually insulates them, and our pets carry them right into our house. Mm-hmm. So we have to be aware, and we have to be proactive year-round. And we have over 30,000 people suffering from Lyme in Connecticut alone. And it's the pandemic that no one's talking about because the focus has been understandably on COVID. Mm-hmm. But Lyme disease is a pandemic, and it's growing at an alarming rate. And the costs associated with it, not only the cost of treatment, but the cost of lost income, of lost, you know, just dreams and desires that you've had to alter, you know, it's a substantial cost.
Yeah.
And it's time to really start understanding Lyme and treating it and really advocating for change in the CDC so that the patients that are in treatment can receive the coverage financially that they desperately need.
Jessica Snyder, I can't agree with you more. I think you've hit the nail on the head. And again, Jessica is the founder and executive director of Partner in Lyme. Again, this is a 501c charitable organization that Jessica and her husband created last year after her own daughter was diagnosed with Lyme disease and is battling it today. Now, help me to understand this a little bit, Jessica. If somebody wants to, let's just say, either donate. It's a two-part question. First of all, if you want to donate to it, how do you do it? And then second of all, if you're somebody who is struggling with Lyme, how do you benefit from your organization?
Sure. Let me talk about the donations first,
okay,
because there's no shortage of people that are in need, mm-hmm, but we can only do the work that we're doing if we have the funding to give it.
Sure.
We give what we get. And so there's several ways that people can donate to our organization. Right now, we're having an exciting partnership with Smart Roof Solar, a Connecticut-based solar company that services nationwide. And they have generously offered to sponsor. If you sign up with them for a residential solar program, they will sponsor one person. So they will give us $1,000. And if it's a commercial property, they will give us $5,000.
Wow.
So that's an exciting opportunity. If you're interested in doing solar, or if you're listening and you are a business owner, you know, that's one way that you can do something good for your business, but also support ours. We are having some fundraising. So our website is partnerinlyme.org, and you can find the information about Smart Roof Solar, our coloring page fundraiser, and we will be launching our yearly release of our t-shirts in May. There's also a place where you can donate year-round. So there's a donate button. It goes straight to the donation page. And we really encourage people to donate. We are really grateful for the base of donors that we've had this past year. We have grown, even in this challenging economic time. We've had a really loyal base of donors and supporters and people that are really encouraging us financially and prayerfully in the work that we're doing. And
that's
we're very,
beautiful.
Very grateful for that.
That's great.
And then second part of your question, if you're someone that is in need, on our website, you can go to the Apply tab. And we keep our process fairly simple. We just ask for some basic information and some confirmation of your diagnosis. And we distribute one financial gift a month. And again, with more funding, we'll be able to increase that hopefully to two a month. So as our funding grows, our ability to give gifts will grow. And what we really love to celebrate is the fact that we called ourselves Partner in Lyme because we want to make partnerships, whether you're a charitable business or person. We want to get to know you. We want to have a relationship with you. And we are really proud to say that we are friends almost with a lot of the people that we have given financial assistance to. Before the pandemic hit, I would hand deliver our financial gifts.
Mm-hmm.
So we would get together and we would say hello. And now that things are opening back up again, which I know you talked about earlier, that allows us to now hand deliver our gifts again and meet and smile at each other and get to know one another. So our relationships stay long after that $1,000 is cashed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that, you know, I think makes us a little bit different and just kind of gives people hope that there's someone here really supporting you and encouraging you and thinking of you and praying for you throughout your whole treatment.
And again, that is partnerinlyme.org if you want to donate or check it out, apply, learn a little bit more. Jessica, I'm so glad I got connected to you, and I would love to have you back on the show really soon. I think the information that you have and also the work you're doing, it's so valuable, and I think it would touch a lot of my listeners. So I'd love to have you back on the show really soon.
I would love that. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So there's a push. I believe it's Mark Zuckerberg. Krista can correct me if I'm wrong. But this idea of creating an Instagram for kids, it would be for kids 13 and under. Krista Karnes, first of all, welcome to the show, our social media consultant. What do you think about a kid's Instagram?
Oh, it's pretty complicated. But I, you know, in my jaded marketing brain, I know it's really, it feels like just a feeder to regular Instagram and all the platforms, which is really, in the end, a way for Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, to make money. You know, I mean, like, they're all, it's monetizing, it's advertising. I mean, we do let them watch TV. We do let them, you know, we can't keep them safe. And, you know, in theory, the idea that they could create a safer platform where, you know, adults and strangers and sort of nefarious people could reach them is makes sense. I mean, I think we're raising kids in a, you know, these are social media, you know, natives, and, you know, they see us on it, they see, you know, their friends on it. So to give them a platform to share their joys and their photos and, you know, things about them, their lives with others is not inherently a bad idea, I don't think, but I just... It, you know, it's still technology. There's always a way around it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not sure. I got my son an Oculus. He's 10, and that's a Facebook-owned device. And I have to use my Facebook account to set him up with that. So there's a little integration there where I get to monitor everything that happens.
Oh, that's interesting.
But I also don't let... Yeah, so I think they would probably, you know, from what I did some reading on it and stuff, I do think that they would try to connect it to the parent account because or require an adult to be the sort of main contact on it, because kids don't have you know, identification. Like, you know, they have a birth date and anybody can say they have a birth date. So
right.
I think we're a ways off from them doing it, but I do I don't know, it's a little bit, if there is some gates, it's just a matter of will the adults in their lives monitor that. And I think,
yeah,
I think that's almost the larger question. I mean, I heard a terrible story from a friend of mine who her 11-year-old daughter was on Roblox, which is this silly little game online, but there's chats that can start and people that you don't know can, and she ended up having, I mean, it was ultimately pretty innocent, but there was a relationship her daughter was having online for 3 months that she knew nothing about.
Wow.
And there's a lot of migration. So somebody finds you on one platform and says, hey, then let's go over to this platform where it's, mm-hmm. you know, and I, you know, those are the kinds of things that I, you know, we have to educate ourselves as parents
right.
on all the time. It's, you're never done.
Mm-hmm.
So just because you did some research 2 years ago,
yeah.
you are not up to date, you know?
Well, and you know, Krista, it's such a catch-22, because immediately when I heard about this, I immediately am like, are you kidding? Let's make more platforms for kids to do whatever they're doing. But then the other side of it, which you bring up a very good point, is the ability to monitor. Like, you know, in the social media world, it's so easy. Kids will make like fake accounts that their parents don't even detect. And I just think because we've already opened up Pandora's box, I think the more that we can at least help parents to track their kids and see what's going on versus to just be oblivious. Like everything you just said to me, I have never heard of any of those platforms. I don't know what anything you just said. I love you. I love you to pieces, but I have no clue what you just said. I understand what you said,
right.
but I've never heard of either of those platforms. And I think, you know, it's sort of that concept of like, look, you could tell a kid till they're blue in the face, don't go to college and party. Okay. Don't drink, don't party, don't
right.
have premarital sex, but they're going to do it. They're going to do it. Most kids are going to do it. So do you sit there and just tell them, no, or do you try to work with the reality of this is what we're living in right now? So it's a tough balance. It's a hard I'm gonna let you talk.
It's a really tough balance, and if you want it to be, it can be like another full time job. So
right, true.
You know, because you have, you know, there are apps out there. You know, Circle by Disney, Bark is one, and even their monitoring platforms, which are really smart, right? Mm-hmm. They're coded to like pick up phrases that are going to, you know, not only let you know if somebody is interacting with your child inappropriately, but if your child is sending messages on Google Chat that may be leaning towards depression or maybe, you know, like really scary stuff, but they alert you. Now, the problem is you get so many alerts that going through it, especially when your kids are so young and they're, you know, they're not very judicious on that. When they're online, they sometimes, you know, they go crazy. Like my son will have like 125 text messages from his little group chat and stuff. And so you really, it's so easy to be like, this is exhausting. Mm-hmm. But I think when you dig a little deeper and you realize just how scary some of that stuff can be. And there's actually a woman from Connecticut who was working, I believe she was working for Bark at the time, but it was a big article and thing that went viral, but she spent like 2 weeks online posing as an 11-year-old girl on Instagram. And they doctored her face. Like it was an experiment. Mm-hmm. She had, you know, the authorities were helping her. Like it was a very planned thing.
Right.
And what, the second she went on and slipped and said that she was because kids will give away information that they're not even thinking.
Sure.
Right. And so, you know, and what came out of the woodwork was just horrific.
That's insane.
And that was only 2 weeks, you know. So I think we have to get over the fear of knowing what's out there. I think we also have to not be knee-jerk and say, maybe, you know, no, there's nothing in my house, you know. But when you watch, like, The Social Dilemma on Netflix.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Right? And
mind-blowing.
Like, and I just was reading this article. The head of Instagram doesn't post his own kids' faces on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a lot of them don't even let their kids on social media yet.
Yeah.
So even if you pull back, and then we have to teach the kids about when something makes you feel uncomfortable. If your parent or your guardian or the adult in your life would be upset to know that something happened, that's when you know that it's wrong. Like,
right,
that's when you know it's time to share.
Yeah.
And as long as we create an open environment that allows them to tell us, then we can teach them. So I think it's, mm-hmm. so it's not whether can they be on Instagram or not. I would prefer a platform that had a lot of, a lot of technology in place to protect them as
monitor.
Much as possible,
yeah.
even though I admit it's never going to be foolproof.
Right.
But I do know people who let their 10-year-olds have regular Instagram accounts, you know, so.
Yeah, it's true. It's, you know, and I think you make such a good point, Krista, that it's so easy sometimes to just blame the company. And look, I do think that it's a moneymaker. It's a profiter,
yeah.
You know, like that's what it comes down to. But okay, so we got the facts in front of us. It's going to come down to what are you going to do with it? You know, it's not a matter of do they do it or do they not? What do you do with it? And I think that's what you're kind of bringing up this morning. And I so appreciate looking at it because you're right. I think sometimes you see these headlines and we're so stuck in, oh, this is awful, but it's happening. So what do you do with it? And I love your insight this morning, Krista. Thank you so much.
Thanks. No problem.
Yeah. And Krista, if anybody wants to connect with you on Twitter or anything like that, where can they go to find you?
Twitter's probably the easiest. It's at KristaCarnes.com. That's my open public platform. So, and you can actually find a lot of really good, you know, internet monitoring, social media monitoring for kids. Like you'll find a lot of links there. If I have a few minutes later, maybe I'll throw some up there. But, you know, definitely educate yourselves and just don't take on more than you can handle, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're debating something, don't let them on every single platform. Try, you know, keep yourself to one or two and then see what you can monitor. And get all the adults in your life involved, right? Your friends.
Love that, yeah.
You know, because I would want my friend to tell me if they saw my kid put something up inappropriate that I may have missed or,
true.
You know, something that was scary. So engage your whole community.
It takes a village, that's for sure. Krista Carnes, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, and we'll talk in a couple of weeks.
All right, have a great one, Melissa.
Thanks, you too.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help.
Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
I felt like Billy Joel said it perfectly. If you've ever watched the movie Oliver and Company, and as a kid, I used to remember this song when he'd say, "Why should I worry? Why should I care?" And yet, we worry so much about what people think about us. And it's not like that's just a problem we have as kids. I mean, Julius Dudix, wouldn't you agree this is something we carry well into our adulthood? Why do we do that?
Absolutely. Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, that's a great question. It's a great topic because so many allow other people's opinions not only to hurt us, but oftentimes to define us as people. And it can inhibit you from living your life, from enjoying life, because your entire being, your personality, your thoughts, your actions are controlled or by an idealized standard of what other people want to see. And you become so, people sometimes become so obsessed with it.
Yeah.
That you forget your own, who you really are.
Why do we do that though, Julius? Like, why is it human nature that we just naturally are so worried about what people think? Like, we have to actively train ourselves not to care, but we do. We do care.
We do. And you know what? It's normal to care. So don't get the idea that nobody cares what other people think, because we all do that. That's a normal thought process. But we care so much because our happiness many times depends on the quality of relationships that we have with those around us.
Oh, good point.
And when that relationship, those relationships falter, we end up becoming sad, depressed, anxious, stressed, and so forth. So the key is to understand who you really are, because really, ultimately, at the end of the day, you lay your head on the pillow and you've got to ask yourself the question, you know, was I pleased today with myself and who I am and where I'm headed and everything?
Mm-hmm.
So really, it really becomes an issue of self-esteem. But as a Christian counselor, Melissa, I believe we were made for God's glory.
Mm-hmm.
And when we view ourselves the way he views us, we feel better about ourselves, because it's almost like you're in a room and in one mirror is your mother-in-law. In another mirror is your boss. In another mirror is your spouse. In another mirror is a friend. And we feel about ourselves the way they view us. In other words, if they're happy with us, we feel happy about ourselves.
Yeah.
If they say something snarky about us, we feel awful about ourselves. And we continually go through the process of viewing ourselves based upon what other people think about us.
I love that image. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. I love that image, though, of like people in the mirrors looking at you. That's so true.
Yeah. But what if God were in that mirror? And what if, you know, because his love for us is unconditional.
Mm-hmm.
So if he's in the mirror, then we feel better about ourselves because he knows we're broken. I'm broken. You're broken. Everybody's broken.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all selfish at times, or we're all pigheaded at times, or we're all nasty at times. But he forgives us and he loves us.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can put him in the mirror and look at ourselves the way we were created in his image, then we feel better about ourselves.
Yeah.
And that we always love ourselves more when we're more loving.
That's true.
I don't like myself when I'm angry, when I'm frustrated, when I'm snarky and irritable.
Amen to that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We love ourselves more when we're loving and kind and patient with other people. And then that draws other people to us.
Mm-hmm.
But it really starts by understanding your identity in the fact that God loves you unconditionally. And then it's not what we do that determines who we are, but who we are that determines what we do. In other words, we're not defined by how much money we have in the bank or car we drive or, but society screams that, you know, we're defined by that. When we understand, you know, who we really are, we're a loved child of Almighty God. It makes us feel better about ourselves.
Yeah.
As a Christian counselor, that's how I view things.
Well, and you know what also is interesting, Julius Dudix, is when I think about it, it's funny. And I don't know if I'm like totally out in left field with this one. But you know what I find interesting is that we will go through life. So when we were kids, we didn't know who our mother-in-laws were. We didn't know who our spouses were. We didn't know who our future friends were. We didn't know who anybody was. Like, virtually, we knew who our parents were, and we knew who, if you had siblings, you knew who your siblings were. We didn't really know anyone. And isn't it amazing how we get older? People who virtually did not know us at the core, did not know us when we first started out on this earth, or didn't know us from the very beginning and how we were created and our image and everything. Isn't it amazing how in life later on, their opinions are so important to us, but there was a time where they didn't even exist. You know what I mean?
Right. And all of a sudden, we give that so much power.
Yeah.
And when we give that so much power, we end up being paralyzed ourselves, and we don't enjoy life.
Right.
And that's the travesty that, you know, what do you think about most of the day? You know, do you think about the people who love you or the people who are negative toward you?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we allow ourselves to train our brains to think about the negativity and what this person said. And, you know, statistically, it takes 7 positives to undo 1 negative comment.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, it breaks my heart because, you know, Julius, I've got friends, for example, who either, you know, get married. Like, let's just take the in-laws. And I don't want to say in-laws are all, because I happen to, well, my husband doesn't have parents, but his family is very, very kind to me and vice versa. My husband has a great relationship with my parents. But, you know, like, not everyone has horrible in-law stories. My brother, same thing. He's got great in-laws, and my sister-in-law has my parents. But some people, like, I have friends who literally, they will love themselves. They will think they are great additions to the world, and I would agree with them. And then, like, their in-laws will make them feel like they're 2 inches tall. And I'm like, wait a minute. You liked yourself before you met this person. I don't understand why you let them define you. It's crazy, but yeah. I understand it, the insecurity we get.
Yeah. And, you know, the idea is when people come at us like that, you've got to take a step out of the woods and say, why are they saying what they're saying?
Right. Yes.
You know, because a lot of times they're so broken, they're just projecting their anger.
And on you. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's gentle answer turns away wrath. A harsh word stirs up all the anger. But, you know, the bottom line is we have one life to live, and that life is short. And so do we want to spend even a few minutes worrying about what other people think, or do we want to just say, hey, listen, we need to let go of it and practice a almost desensitize ourselves to what other people think about us. Again, it is common. It's so normal for people to be worrying about what other people think or say about us.
Mm-hmm.
But when it gets in the way of your ability to move forward, and if that's an oppressive thought, If 24/7 you're thinking about, you know, that snarky boss or that whatever, there's a root of bitterness there that needs to be pulled out.
Yeah, we got
to
find some
peace. Replaced with,
yeah,
you got to replace it with God's love.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens and his strength and his power within you, it helps you to deal with the snarky boss or the unruly spouse or whoever you're dealing with.
But yeah.
You've got to ask yourself the question, am I being defined by other people or am I being defined by a God who loves me? And that's, as a Christian counselor, that's kind of where I come from.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There's hope. There is hope. And,
totally.
And again, I don't want to paint a picture that, you know, anybody can go through life without thinking about what other people think.
But oh, yeah, that's just crazy.
Does it affect your quality of life?
Right. That's the question.
What do you do about it is the question.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to acknowledge it. Ask why I'm thinking this way. Does it go back to my childhood?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, defining moments there, build on the truth. You know, visualize what would your life be like if it were freed from all these snarky people who, you know, are trying to define me.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, Julius, I think you bring up such a great topic, and I thank you so much for diving into it this morning. Looking forward to connecting again next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Have
all
a good day.
You too.